The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You see the increase in socialism, you see the increase in populism post-2008. So translate the same dynamics to the U.S. With economic prosperity comes greater probability of peace. With economic crisis or stagnation comes an increased probability of a very muscular foreign policy.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. I was having lunch with a good friend of mine last Wednesday. He has been diagnosed with terminal cancer. He's fourth stage, and he's an amazing guy, though. He's ready to go. He's one of the toughest guys that I know, but, you know, he shared with me something very personal, but I think is profound, and I think a lot of us would relate to, Dave. He said, you know, Kevin, I look back at my life, and he says, I think the guys who were the toughest on me were the ones who cared the most about me. And it reminded me of a conversation you and I had a couple of nights ago as we prepared for this program. You shared the thankfulness that you had for some of the people who were in your background.
Yeah, going back to when I was in college, the professors who were the hardest on me, they're the ones that I today continue to have the greatest amount of respect for. And I woke up from, I guess it was a dream of some sort, a year ago, and had on my mind a couple of the men who had left major impressions on me, and been thinking about writing them a letter just to express my gratitude for their investment and just who they are, but what they required of us as students. It was remarkably different. Not all teachers are the same, and some have a real concerted purpose to what they're doing. And so I'm getting some of those letters written, and I think it's a good practice to look at that for which and to those whom we are grateful for.
Well, and you know, it reminds me, there are a lot of times in our life where friction is the very thing that we need. That type of person, those tough teachers, and you know, this person that my friend was talking about, these people who were tough on him, who he now looks back and realizes they cared the most about his outcomes. Those friction moments are actually the way that we are sharpened, you know, iron sharpening iron. And I think of some of the people, Dave, that you surround yourself with now. They don't always agree with you. Oftentimes, you have some pretty heated conversations about what you're trying to analyze. But that's what this program is for. Yeah, I think of even Doug Noland or Jim Deeds or, you know, people in your background, some of the people who've passed, you know, Ian McCavity, some of the guests that we've had on this program. And speaking of Doug Noland, who's somebody that you followed for years, and I have too, we have another conference call coming up for the Tactical Short with Doug Noland on it.
Yeah, January 24th. This is next Thursday. Mark your calendars. We have the quarterly conference call for the Tactical Short offering, and you'd register and join us for the discussion of 2019, secular shift, beginning the long, difficult road. You know, looking at Doug's comments from the weekend, the Credit Bubble Bulletin, on crisis dynamics and how they tend to be a process, he says there's the manic phase followed by some type of shock. There is at least a partial recovery and a return to optimism that's often bolstered by a dovish central bank response. It's the second major leg down when things turn more serious for sentiment, for market dynamics, and for illiquidity. Disappointment turns to disenchantment and eventually revulsion. It's been a long time since market participants were tested by a prolonged grinding bear market.
So what he's saying is, how many times can you goose the system artificially until it starts to actually recognize that we are in a bear?
Yeah. Now, there's a consistent theme of slowing economic activity globally, and some of those indicators are now in the U.S. as well, although we've held up pretty well here in recent years. You get corporate tax receipts down $9 billion. Of course, you can look at the tax deals that have been done and maybe lay it at the feet of those negotiated pieces. But individual receipts are down $17 billion. This is the interesting thing for me. You've got interest costs on the national debt, which are up $16 billion for the quarter as we close out this last year. So interest costs for December are up 47%. compared with December of 2017.
You know what it reminds me of? Our guest Pollock, who was on a couple of months ago, who said your income can fall or your assets can fall, but your liabilities stay the same. Now, what you're pointing out here with the tax receipts being down is our income is falling and our liabilities are actually increasing.
Because of the structure of our debt. So, yeah, with debt at $21.9 trillion, just a hair below $22 trillion, and growing at a greater than $1 trillion annual pace, there is the component of a growing base of debt. But the bigger issue here is that we've seen a bump up in interest rates, and that interest cost, again, from one December to the next, is up by 47%.
Well, for the few people who actually make things still here in America, factory orders are down, are they not?
Well, exactly. So that economic slowdown, which is happening globally, you are seeing some indications of it here on our shores. U.S. factories ended 2018 on a very sour note. Bloomberg noted this, that you had all five regional gauges, which were down for the first time in 2 years. Then we had the announcement January 3rd from the Institute for Supply Management that that index dropped the most since 2008. The gauge dropped 5.2 points, and a decline of that magnitude, according to Bloomberg, has only occurred twice in this century. Both times were in the context of a recession. One was the financial crisis a decade ago, and the other was following the September 11th 2001 terror attacks.
These dates are so important because a lot of times when these things occur, you can go back and say, well, gosh, that was right before the last two crashes. Now, we were talking about U.S. factory orders and growth, but this is not just a United States phenomenon.
No, factory growth fell to a three-year low in the Eurozone. So you've got that in that neck of the woods. Also in Asia, you've got China leading on the downside as factory gauges signaled a contraction for the first time since the middle of 2017. On their heels, you've got Taiwan and Malaysia and South Korea, which, according to Bloomberg, you know, again, China's sort of leading the pack on the downside in terms of factory growth. South Korea, they're an export giant. I mean, we know China is too, but the summary here is that this is not a country-specific issue. This is not even a regional issue, but there is a global slowdown afoot.
When you go to Munich, Germany, one of the most prominent high towers is the BMW factory. Germany really is the engine of growth in Europe. I mean, if you think about it, we look at these other surrounding countries, but Germany has really been the engine of growth, and I think that they're slowing down as well.
That's what we saw last week when we got the German industrial production numbers, weaker than expected, making for 2 months a back-to-back industrial production declines, and it suggests that Germany's very close to recession. As you say, this is the economic engine of Europe, and I think maybe if we look for the next month's numbers, the next release of the German IP numbers may be definitive in terms of that German recession and, ergo, I think, European recession.
One of the things that's sort of allowed us to ignore the fact that there's been a slowdown, because this has been happening for a while, is that the stock market had been gaining each year. Well, 2018 changed that.
It marked the worst year for stocks in a decade. And as we talked about last week, the performance numbers, while negative, were not all that bad. 6 to 12% was the range, with, you know, the Russell 2000 down just over 12%, the S&P down 6.2%, and the Dow off 5.6%. The real weakness was in that last quarter, because we actually had most of the year, which we were just fine and everyone felt fine and nothing appeared to be wrong. But, you know, here we are with the fourth quarter being behind us, this three-month rough patch, and we're to understand now, according to the news media, that this decade-long bull market in everything, in every asset class, was moderated and the excesses of that period were corrected in a matter of about 3 months.
You know, Durango's known for its steam engines. You know, we have the trains running three times a day up north to Silverton. When you're near the roundhouse and they're getting those things stoked up, they have something where they let off steam. That's where we get the term letting off steam. I think a lot of people would say that this letting off steam has now moderated the market and we have only to go up from here.
Well, that's right. You've got a bunch of the banks saying, look, there's a good reason for us to just motor higher from here. BNP Paribas in France, Morgan Stanley, Goldman analysts, they think, and granted, they're kind of seeing the world through the glass half full analysis. And, you know, there's the belief that trade compromise is going to emerge. And they may be right, but again, it's nothing in terms of details have emerged yet, but there is this belief that, all right, we're going to get a compromise there, and China's going to pull through economically. And Brexit, yeah, it's going to pass over after March. It's not really that big of a deal. And, you know, so all of these areas of political uncertainty, they're going to dissipate. And we were talking, Doug Nolan and I were talking yesterday, and he said, you know, this was commentary that we used to get in the 90s all the time. It was called looking across the valley. So you kind of ignore what's immediately ahead of you and directly below you, and you keep your eyes on the rise across the valley. Let's not be distracted by what is going to happen today or tomorrow, but thinking positively, we're already on the other side of the valley.
Speaking of valleys, I think of Sonoma Valley, and you can sometimes have little bit too much of the vin of the grape, even when you're visiting Napa. You know, great wines, but you have to moderate. We have excess wine in the form of liquidity over the last decade. And in a way, it's a little bit like walking around in a drunken stupor. I wonder if people are analyzing the economy based on just a continual consumption of this elixir.
Yeah, I've got a race in Sonoma at the end of July.
Yeah.
So I'll be there, but I won't be imbibing all that much until at least we're in the recovery phase from the race. But no, you know, you're right. The excesses of a decade, we've had the loosest monetary policy here in this past decade outside of major hyperinflationary events. So you could say this is as generous as the poor's could get. This is the most liquidity that we've seen outside of acute hyperinflationary
events. Yet we're still seeing bankruptcies. We're still seeing companies close for forever.
The fascinating part to me is that Wall Street has this ingrained belief and bias that 3 months of market volatility cleans up a decade's worth of that kind of excess liquidity. Okay. I mean, I guess that's possible, but you know, you've got Sears, which is gone, 126-year-old business, which this last week, you know, called it quits. They're kaput. 50,000 people are going to be looking for work. Not to worry. You talk to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 50,000 unemployed. That's a rounding error.
They're not employed right now. The Bureau of Labor Statistics right now, they're not even doing the numbers.
Oh.
Remember, they're not getting paid.
That's right.
Yeah.
Pobrecito. That's what we would say in our family. Poor little fellows.
Well, speaking of that, let's just look at the politics then, because we not only have an economic situation that's been fueled for 10 years with free money, this elixir that I was talking about, but the political environment has never been so divisive.
Yeah, I love seeing the Financial Times just kind of transitioning back from that comment about so little time to correct such a long bull market. The Financial Times said if 2008 was the first year that tested the resilience of the global markets to a switch from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening, this was from the Financial Times January 7th, the results did not inspire confidence. Investors began the year unprepared for the renewed volatility that came as the Federal Reserve rolled back more of its insurance liquidity. The fact a strong U.S. jobs market and historically low policy rates could not prevent U.S. stocks having their worst December since 1931 confirmed that a decade of repressing volatility had left the market with a weak immune system. The central issue facing markets now is where the new clearing level for risk lies. Has recent turbulence reset market fundamentals to more sustainable levels, or does it portend greater pain to come?
Well, let me ask. I mean, does the market, even if it could go up, does it ignore what's going on politically?
Well, and I think this is, you know, Bill King commented on it last week. The political environment is now conducive for a bear market, he said in one of his recent reports. And, you know, reflecting on that, it's not just that we have a divided government. It's more than, you know, the government shutdown or, you know, Fitch, the rating service, is now threatening to downgrade U.S. debt should those circumstances with the shutdown persist. It's more than that. It's uncertainty which has come into the air. It's the climate which begins to change, and that allows for a persistent long-term bear. It's one where positive sentiment is replaced with risk aversion. It's where, again, sort of the happy days are here again is somehow undercut by cynicism, and skepticism is now the market response. People say, ah, no, 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 it's not going higher.
Am I hearing you breathe life then into some of the danger investments, the hedge investments like gold?
Well, that gold does very well. It not only in periods or environments where you have political turmoil, but obviously where, whether it's political turmoil or other causes of uncertainty, gold does very well, because you go back to this behavioral shift, this allocation shift made in the context of uncertainty.
Do you remember when Draghi came out and he said, we will do whatever it takes? That was in 2011. That was when gold was hitting its all-time high. And sure enough, everything changed after that.
Very critical, because, you know, King was also commenting as we came into the new year that gold hit its all-time high in 2011. Then something happened that torpedoed gold and induced investors to turn to stocks.
Free money.
Yeah. So this is King's commentary here. Obama was aided and abetted by negative to zero interest rate policies, three quantitative easing programs, a twist, and buku verbal interventions, if not actual manipulation. At some point, large investors and private equity behemoths will become alarmed and rethink the conventional wisdom in regard to the value of paper versus real assets. And this was sometimes King kind of waxes on about, you know, something that happened in the past. In this case, he looks at these major transitions in the 90s. He says, in the 90s, you had the demise of Japan, the USSR, communism, as well as the ascent of democracy, market economies, and globalism, which induced investors to buy paper assets and jettison real assets.
In a way, it was a perfect storm of good news.
Yeah, right. And so the uncertainties of the Cold War era were behind us, mm-hmm. and now we could think differently. In addition, there in the 90s, we had massive changes within the U.S. banking system, which allowed for massive consolidation and an increase in the flows of credit, not only within the banking system as we know it, but really the 80s through the 90s launched our shadow banking, which was a massive credit expansion in non-conventional, non-traditional avenues.
Okay, but look at the perfect storm that started in the global financial crisis in 2008. You had the seeds of things going backwards.
Well, so back to King's comments, he says that after the crisis of 2008, socialism, nationalism, and populism are on the march. And that's a very interesting thing. If you stop and think about this insight, it's critical. It's after the crisis of 2008, socialism, nationalism, and populism are on the march. History is clear, he says, that socialists and their ilk not only come for income, they appropriate assets, including their benefactors' wealth. It's needed to pay for their agenda and assuage the people that put them in power. Now, this goes back to the discussion we had about law and how once the Mississippi system was failing, you still had the wealthy who, in spite of the risk of complete asset confiscation, were willing to hoard gold because they knew that the alternatives were less than options. They would compromise safety in anything but a specie holding. Specie in that day and age being actual gold and silver coins.
Well, and it's interesting. People who were out there saying, you know, well, for the greater good, you need to give up this. The greater good, the greater good. What I find is the greater good, where people are saying you need to pay more taxes, it's usually billionaires that have foundations that have very little income. They're willing to pay 90% taxes on their income because they have none.
They already got rid of all their assets and moved them in a very tax beneficial way to the foundation format. Now, people act in their own self-interest. And you're right, the arguments of the greater good, the, you know, hey, personal sacrifice for the common good, it rings hollow. I mean, it's great as a stump speech or as an article in the New Yorker. But honestly, when you start putting pressure on people, you find that they do move towards things that give them security and safety and don't allow for their pockets to be picked.
You know, one of the things that really calmed me down over the last week was Pelosi and her view of balancing power in Washington. She somehow claims that her position at this point is equal to Trump's.
Are you shooting for an alliteration here, pocket-picking Pelosi?
Oh, that was yours.
No, our congratulations to Mrs. Pelosi, in all sincerity. We are very excited to have her back swinging the gavel.
Oh, stop saying all sincerity. That's a lie, Dave.
It's not. Her recent comments about the Constitution and how the Constitution considers her equal to Trump. I thought that was very insightful. That was very insightful. Now, I mean, I think it should be understood as her reading of the Constitution, which makes her equal to Trump.
I guess you can read things with different interpretations. There's a fancy Latin word for that. I can't remember what it is.
Hermeneutics comes to mind. We could give her an A for effort with her hermeneutics. I don't know.
Are hermeneutics Latin or Greek?
I don't know.
It's a different constitution to me than it is to her.
Right. Yeah. Well, and again, that's because we perhaps see things through a slightly different lens. But I think between Pelosi and Ocasio-Cortez, we have so much to be excited about in the Beltway this new year. I mean, talk about really fun stuff. I love the idea. Ocasio-Cortez has said 70% tax on the ultra rich. This is really where things get interesting. We've got the New Deal. Did you know that we had a New Deal?
Is that the green one?
It's the green New Deal.
Well, it's not easy being green. Kermit the Frog sang that song, you know, and so you've got to have some money to do that.
Well, the last New Deal felt pretty red to me, so maybe maybe this one is green by comparison.
So Buffett, Bezos, Bloomberg, these guys are going to go out there, and I'm sure they're happy to pay that kind of tax.
They'll be first in line to contribute. I mean, if it's a 70% tax on the ultra-rich, these guys are also, again, beyond the champagne that they toast, you know how the guilt complex is, the champagne socialist complex.
Well, and you know, it's interesting, though. We're not talking about the top 1%. We're talking about the top 0.0001% who have foundations. The top 1%, a lot of those people actually fall into the class of not having foundations and having a pretty substantial income that has to be taxed at this point.
Well, and this is where, yeah, the 1% do pay a lot. Mm-hmm. And let me change tone and be a little less tongue-in-cheek. The top 1% pay about 39.4% of all federal income taxes. And if you're talking about the top 20% of income earners, you've got 88%, over 88% of all your federal taxes paid by 20% of the population.
So the majority of the population pays very little of the overall tax bite.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're talking about 80% of the population, they only have to cover the last 12%. But again, you know, the social justice warrior in Ocasio-Cortez, the redistributionist in Ocasio-Cortez says that we have a problem. And that problem is that there's an out of balance economic equation, and she can make that right. The problem is not in tax revenues, in my opinion. It's in spending. It's in the unlimited political promises which basically are given to voters in exchange for their votes. It's the tendency that we have towards adding $1 trillion in new debt each year that we continue to accrue annually, and the fact that that's coinciding with the rise in rates. I think these are issues which ultimately present significant cash flow problems for the government.
You know, I think of the nobility of billionaires' recommendations to the rest of the people, and the nobility of the elite politicians who are literally willing to get rid of national sovereignty. They're like, you know what? We need to even give up that for the greater good.
But you're talking about Merkel. I mean, I wonder, when I hear of the crises in Europe, and I understand that there's Target 2 problems between specific countries where debt loads are huge, Italy being probably the worst offender, close to $500 billion in debt owed to other European countries. But it's more than financial. Merkel was speaking in Berlin just this last week or two. Nation states should be willing to give up their sovereignty today, was one of the themes of her speech. And that's quoted from her speech. Nation states should be willing to give up their sovereignty today. To me, this is a factor. This is a factor in the pressures currently felt within the Eurozone. Politicians that represent their own globalist political views rather than being representatives of the people. There's a reason why I think her political party is on the way out and they're in full-blown crisis. It's also odd to me. I mean, the public schools here in the United States have for the last 20-odd years or so been about celebrating multiculturalism. And yet when you start saying ditch your sovereignty, move towards some sort of blissful union, they're really talking about uniculturalism, aren't they?
I remember going back on this program almost 10 years ago when you had the interview with Otmar Issing, who was the first European Central Bank head, and he also was really the backbone of the founding of the euro. You had asked him and talked about the outcome of the euro and the likelihood that all these separate countries with separate laws would be able to make it work. And he seemed to intimate to you that they knew that if they launched a currency, it would lead to this question. that the currency itself would probably not hold together unless, ultimately, nations yielded their sovereignty. You remember that in the interview?
Sure. And I mean, the conundrum was they wanted to launch the currency because it was the most palatable first step. And yet there's major issues because you're still fiscally separate and politically separate.
And they almost needed it to go to a crisis mode for what Merkel is proposing to actually make sense.
The impossibility on the front end would have been to ask for sovereignty.
Right.
You know, what they wanted to do is create an environment where there are so many economic benefits shared between nations that you could begin to rationalize the giving up of sovereignty. But it's not as if you're giving up complete sovereignty. You're giving up sovereignty to someone. You're ceding control to someone, right?
So somebody you didn't vote for, by the way.
Well, that's the way Brussels operates.
Right.
So giving up sovereignty to whom is the big issue. And I think you're right. There's really not a willingness to move towards giving up sovereignty and fiscal control, except in the context of crisis.
I think that's why it's important as we do these shows and as we look back at history to understand that crisis is not necessarily the enemy of the person who's thinking ahead like the elite politician. Crisis is actually a tool of policy change.
Kevin, I don't remember which guest it was that was on with us that said very matter-of-factly that crisis compresses time.
Oh, that's brilliant.
That stuck with me because there's, again, this idea that there's decades where nothing happens and then weeks where decades happen. And that idea of being able to ratchet forward progress, and maybe it's regress if or you know, not a direction you necessarily want to go, but a lot happens politically in a short period of time. It's because that is the nature of crisis.
I've sort of wondered about this for the last 10 years because it's been crisis free. Okay. And it's been paid for with, you know, financial repression, with interest rates that are lower, sometimes lower than zero. They've smoothed out the volatility until 2018. And I've wondered, Dave, and I honestly don't know the answer to this. If I was an insurance company that was trying to pay a certain amount on an annuity, or if I was a pension fund that actually had a certain guaranteed return to people who are taking pensions, how in the world with negative interest rates can you have some sort of guarantee? I mean, the stock market's been rising, so it's been sort of smoothing that out as well, but the stock market's not rising right now.
Well, last week we did comment on Richard Buchstaber's idea that even as he contributed to the drafting of Dodd-Frank and the resolution of sort of the last war's problems, if you will, the last crisis problems, was setting the stage for the next crisis. And, you know, when it comes to insurance companies and pension funds, I think you could say that the Federal Reserve and the global central banking community has done the same thing, setting up the next crises through their negative and low interest rates over the last decade. Trying to solve a problem, sure, but it does have unintended consequences, and you see that showing up in places like the liability structure for insurance companies and pension funds. Stephanie Pomboy was noting that it was Federal Reserve policies that have done just that, bankrupted U.S. pension systems, the whole system. The funding shortfalls now stand at $6 trillion, $6.18 trillion, roughly 30% of GDP. And she looked back to financial repression as the primary contributor to that. That is, the monetary policy tools that were used, the macroprudential tools that were used by our central bank in the last period of crisis.
And it works as long as the stock market's rising.
Yeah. Now, that brings up the second point, which is although negative rates and financial repression have put the pension system under considerable, you know, really put them behind the eight ball, we see the coming bear market in stocks and bonds as an even more critical factor moving forward. Because although you have a $6 trillion shortfall today, that $6 trillion could exceed 12 or 15 trillion before it's all said and done. When you look at the coincidental decline in asset prices and the simultaneous increase in payouts, because the pension payments from those pensions are in the process of ratcheting higher as boomers continue to retire en masse. Again, factor this in when you're thinking about investing in corporate America over the next, you know, few years. This is one more significant drawdown on the future income of corporate America as a lot of corporations have to make contributions to their pension funds to make up the shortfall.
You know, many people would have said that the banking system was what created the last major crisis, speaking of crisis. Yet, I don't remember seeing bankers actually losing money. The bankers, they made some pretty substantial bonuses through the last crisis. So you have winners and you have losers. Strangely, the winners are often the people who create the crisis.
Well, and I chuckled reading a Bloomberg article that was quoting Larry Summers, and he had this sort of mea culpa where he said, at best, negative rates have been irrelevant, but potentially contractionary due to the negative effect on bank profits. And I thought to myself, wait a minute. I mean, I understand his context as a person in the public policy sphere, right? But bank profits? Really? I mean, negative rates have always been used to rebuild bank capital at the expense of depositors.
Right. I'm not earning any interest. I mean, it's a joke when I look at the 3 cents that I earn in interest.
Not even a cup of coffee on offer there. They used to offer you a coffee maker. Now, to induce you to open an account, now you can't even buy a cup of coffee with the income from the account.
No.
So, I mean, I say, what about the depositor? I mean, you know, at best, a haircut. At worst, you've got a fleecing, which prohibits that depositor, that retiree, what have you, from making ends meet, from paying their bills.
Another multiple-time guest on the show, Stephen Roach, he asked the question, is Apple the canary in the coal mine? You know, you and I are both talking about the stock market now turning down, but the economy, we have not been in a recession in a decade. We haven't really had a stock market fall until this last year. So you have these two factors that are new. And then you have Apple. You know, we talked about the FANG stocks. Apple was worth more than $1 trillion just a few months ago. And it's lost, what, we talked about it last week, about 40% of its value almost. So is it, as Stephen Roach asks, the canary in the coal mine?
We need to have him back on the program. Mm. I think it's been too long. He was chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia. He had a 5-year stretch of doing that and traveled, what, 1 million miles a year.
That's crazy.
That's serious, airline miles.
Yeah, he doesn't do that anymore.
No, I hope that he's using some of those airline miles to travel more pleasurably. Of course, I think at a certain point, you just say, I'm done with traveling. I don't like it. I want to be home. So homebody professor at Yale, Stephen Roach, we haven't talked to him. He was still in the trenches with Morgan Stanley the last time we had him on the program.
Yeah. So it'd be good to talk to him now that he's got the new position.
So this is about the U.S. and China and the trade war. It's certainly a commentary on earnings, but when Apple announced not only a disappointment on earnings, but lowered forward guidance, that's what he was saying. Look, Apple is probably the canary in the coal mine. Roach says that there's likely to be more to come. And I think he's thinking again about this back and forth between the U.S. and China. As I read the quote further, to think that what affects the Chinese has no bearing whatsoever on an otherwise resilient U.S. economy, I think is ludicrous. So again, be careful what you wish for. We win the trade war, but keep in mind they are our third largest export market and the largest growing export market for the United States. So to the degree that we're hurting them and winning, we're also losing simultaneously. And to the degree that they suffer economically, we do too. We're sort of tied at the hip. That's the nature of a world that is globalized.
Could we see a major change just based on a Supreme Court decision?
Well, that's an interesting point because on Apple, I think the original forecast of revenue was between $89 and $93 billion, and they came in at $84 billion, right? So the revenue and the earnings were one issue, but maybe the real issue is not that that market is saturated. Yes, it is saturated, and they just cut their iPhone production by 10%. But to your point, it could be that the Supreme Court decision that's kind of hanging out there threatens Apple's service business. You've got their App Store sales, and it's being argued that they are operating as a monopoly business.
Yeah, no way. Apple, a monopoly? No. Yeah, that's like calling Amazon a monopoly.
No, certainly not. And there's no political risk in Amazon or Apple. Equal to 37% of all of their service revenue is the App Store sales, estimated to come in at about $46 billion in 2019. You might consider that a material event if, in fact, they get a negative ruling, right? So earnings season is getting underway, not just for Apple, but we've got lots of folks who will be doing exactly what we saw Citigroup do here recently. Classic trick is to lower earnings estimates just before the release, and then on that basis, you announce a surprise number above the just recently lowered expectations, right? and you look like a hero. Sometimes you need to look a little deeper, look at revenue, look at sales growth, and see if they're not just playing the earnings game, the announcement game, and the share buyback game, all to sort of game the system and to basically treat the average investor like a patsy.
Well, and again, these games work when you have low volatility, which we had really for the last decade until last year. I think of low volatility when it's being managed by the Federal Reserve as like somebody saying, nothing to see here, citizen, move on, nothing to see here. But you know, when you have volatility, the games you're talking about don't work.
Whatever is in play gets exaggerated. So we had 64 days this last year where the S&P 500 was up or down more than 1%. Compare that, a volatile year, with a year with virtually no volatility. By contrast, there's only 8 of those days in 2017.
You know, and that's, we took a nap. In 2017, you and I talked about a lot of things, but we couldn't talk about volatility because it was not there.
No. The last 2 weeks of the year here, 2018, saw the Dow fall more than 350 points. 6 different times.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a 10-day period.
Yeah, but we got it all back. Remember the 1,000-point gain?
Sure. Yeah. Largest single-point rise in terms of points, the largest single rise in the Dow ever. What we expect 2019 is to be basically be a continuation of that kind of volatility, that kind of trend. There are implications here, certainly implications for the leveraged community. And I think anyone who wants to press a little deeper, we mentioned the Tactical Short conference call. Certainly join us for that. 2019, the secular shift, beginning the long and difficult road. But I would also encourage you to look at a very fascinating discussion of the currency market implications in 2019. Doug Noland wrote that up in the Credit Bubble Bulletin this weekend, because again, you're talking about currencies which have been used to fund leveraged speculation. And now with greater volatility in the asset markets, it makes your leveraged bets that much harder to manage. So as a consequence of the volatility, you not only begin to see an unwind of many of those leveraged bets, but then you also begin to see volatility in the borrowing currencies, the carry trade currencies. So very interesting commentary. I would encourage you to go back, mwealthm.com, look for the CBB Credit Bubble Bulletin page there, and you can register for the conference call at the same time.
Well, my heart has ached over the last 10 years for the person who needs income from their retirement, because you can either get it from treasuries and safe bonds when interest rates are not controlled.
Or you can chase yield.
You can be in the stock market, but a lot of people say, no, I'm not going to play in the stock market. I'll just buy bonds. Well, the problem is bonds, we're not talking about A or B bonds. We're talking about bonds. The only way a person can really get an income on a bond is by going out in what used to be called junk.
Yeah, well, and junk bonds are interesting. But before we move past that idea of investors moving from a reliable income source to speculating in stocks because of sort of the dividend ploy or dividend play, in an environment where there was low volatility, the case was much easier to make that, look, you know, you've got low interest rates in CDs, low interest rates in treasury bills. You can beat those annual income returns by buying the stock that's paying you 3%.
Sure. Could Apple even fall?
The interesting thing is you go up 1%, 1.5% in your income.
Right.
And here in 2018, 2019, you see that you can actually lose 20 or 30%. 23% if you're talking about off-peak numbers for some of your indexes, you can lose far more than your extra 1.5% in income in how long? Weeks? Months?
Yeah.
Not that long.
It
compresses time. Now, so junk bonds, they are an interesting story because junk bond issuance, as we came into the end of the year, obviously you've got the financial market seizing up a bit and greater concern about what it meant to issue new bonds, if there was going to be an appetite for it. Actually, total issuance for the year declined by 42%. So there was a lot smaller appetite for the issuance of bonds. This week marks the first issuance in over a month of high yield debt. And that kind of a time out hasn't happened in over a decade. So couple that with last year's liquidation from junk bond funds. $60 billion was liquidated last year from those funds. So low issuance, net liquidations of $60 billion, a total dry spell at the end of the year, just broken here this week. And, you know, of course, it's with rising interest rates and a decline in oil prices, which are exaggerating all of those trends in high yield. It's very interesting to see that the dynamics within the market can change in a heartbeat.
Yeah, the appetite for risk sometimes shows up in different ways. And, you know, the appetite for treasuries has been very, very low because, gosh, when you can make the profits that you can make in the equities market or in maybe a junk bond market, why would you buy treasuries?
Well, and I think maybe there's a reappraisal, a small reappraisal going on with treasuries. It's traditional safe haven. And yet even with sort of the machinations there at the end of 2018 in the stock market, we didn't have massive interest in the treasury market. It was very interesting. We were just talking about the high yield or the junk market, but fascinating that in the fixed income markets at the other end of the quality spectrum in U.S. treasuries, we had the lowest bid to cover ratios in at least a decade for U.S. treasuries. Dave Burgess mentioned that in his Friday wrap up this last week. But what that means is that last year saw the shortest line of investors waiting to buy treasuries in a decade. And so as we look forward to 2019, not only are we continuing to increase the amount of debt that we have, we've got rollover stuff that has to come and either be repaid or just extended into the future, evergreen, so to say. Who will be in queue this year? And China does factor into this. We need participants. We need people who are buying our treasuries. Who's going to be in queue if last year, 2018, saw the shortest queue in a decade?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up because Russia got rid of virtually all of their treasuries and China has not been a big buyer of treasuries. And so like you're saying, who's going to actually fund our debt? I mean, the whole program worked for about 40 years where China just bought everything that we were going into debt on and we just bought everything from them for cheaper than what we could make it here. It's not
reasonable quid pro quo.
It's not worried. Well, speaking of China, okay, that's a hope. Right now, people are hanging on the thin thread of hope of really good news coming from China trade negotiations. The thing is, it seems to be dragging on, Dave. I keep hearing about this hope of some sort of breakthrough with China, and Trump keeps tweeting about the progress that they're making. Is it a false hope?
Yeah, I think it was over 6 months that Donald Trump was announcing from Mar-a-Lago that he had worked something out with the Chinese and this was going to be great. And I mean, actually, I think 6, 9, 12 months now, it's been kind of
just you wait.
Yeah,
just you wait.
We've come up with the agreement. We've got it here. But, you know, not only is he not specific, Trump not specific, the Chinese, and this is an insight again from Bill King, the Chinese appear to be utilizing the U.S. trade negotiating strategy that Japan employed for decades, which is you agree to negotiations, you make broad promises, but you make no concrete concessions on the belief that the U.S. will eventually go away.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And, you know, time, though, talking about a compression, time is starting to compress for China because as long as they're growing and as long as things are going well politically and financially and economically, they can get away with a lot of time. But at this point, China is at an interesting juncture, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I'm reading a book right now about credit and politics and the intersection there and basically how when we look at banking crises are always caused by political choices. It's not just about, you know, inadequate loan loss reserves or reducing reserve requirements to the point where there's too much leverage in the banking system or there are political players who are catered to. And that is what gives us credit and banking crisis.
It's politics. So regulation actually plays to the winners and picks the losers.
Yeah, you can't separate politics from banking crisis. Mm. And that's the case of this book. It's a 500-page case, and I think he makes it very well, looking at both British and American history. Actually, beyond that, he looks at Mexican banking, Brazilian banking, a whole lot of different
case studies. You've spoken of having him on in next month when you finish the book.
Absolutely. Yeah. But China is at this interesting juncture because, you know, one, you've got the equity market, which sold off 25-26% last year. The backdrop is what's really critical because you got $40 trillion in bank assets. Right?
Wow.
This is their banking system, it's bigger than ours, which on a smaller basis of a smaller economy doesn't really make sense. But here's the official line from the Chinese is that they've got minimal loan losses.
Trust us.
Yeah.
Yeah, trust us. We've got minimal loan losses.
No losses here. Move along. And yet, again, these are just things that don't quite add up. 65 million recently constructed apartments, which are sitting vacant.
Oh, that's no problem. That's a low vacancy rate.
If anybody's familiar with land development, or I mean, that's a couple properties.
65 million.
65 million empty apartments, but the banking system's fine. It's healthy. We got $40 trillion in assets.
Move along, citizen. Nothing to see here.
Something doesn't add up.
Yeah.
You know, this last year, we have India, which surpasses China as the primary driver of global GDP growth. Yeah, that's an interesting story. Obviously, the economy in India is still smaller, but they were a greater contributor to GDP growth this last year. India was. They are, as we mentioned earlier, China is our third largest and most rapidly expanding export market. And the U.S. is absolutely implicated in the financial market and or economic disruptions to the status quo there in China.
Well, and we're talking about a different system. It hasn't felt like a different system over the last 10, 20 years, China. But we're talking about a system that's communist. They deal with compression of time, these crises, very different than a free market would.
Well, and I'm telling you that this book by Calamiris, I'm just getting to the section of that book where he deals with autocracy. And I haven't read it yet. But the way that credit and credit crises and banking crises are handled in a top-down management structure, as opposed to how it's handled within a democracy. Mm. It's still politics, and there's still chosen winners and losers, but it looks a little bit, the process is different.
I think a little more blood flows from the top.
Well, I was going to say the process is probably a little bit more violent, but here we are at the 100-year anniversary. May 4th were the protests, and yeah, that led 2 years later to the creation of the Communist Party in China. You've got some unsettledness within the Politburo this year because 70 years after May 4th, 1919 was the Tiananmen student massacre, 1989 to be precise.
Yeah, I remember in the trade room here at ICA, actually when we were in the Denver office, we had the TVs on and we saw that tank and we saw that student. Tiananmen Square, it was very present at the time.
But so one notable development in 2018, again, we've got banking crises which are looming. I don't know how you avoid sort of the cleanup or the necessary loss taking on the $40 trillion stock of loans which has been made there in China. But one of the notable developments is that the Bank of China hasn't slowed down in their lending. In fact, they moved to being the top underwriter of emerging market bonds last year.
Hmm.
So, I mean, they're continuing to sort of forge ahead. Not only in recent years have they launched their first aircraft carrier and expanded their geographic reach with the Spratlys and the Paracel Islands, but look, they're also launching a different kind of aircraft carrier. It's the banking relationship. It's the loan with perhaps a few strings attached. Being the largest underwriter of emerging market bonds last year, I think was very significant.
And so this leads me to remember what we've talked about now this whole time on the program. You repeat that the financial moves to the economic, which moves to the political. And then you get to something, the geostrategic or the geopolitical, and that's where real war occurs. So we're not talking just about people's retirement or their 401k going down if there's a dislocation in the market. We're literally talking about a change in world geopolitics.
These are the crisis dominoes that we've been talking about for the 10, 11 years that we've been on the program. And, you know, again, roll the clock back 10 years ago, and you've got the financial leading to the economic.
Right.
And the economic leading to the political. We've had Dodd-Frank and we've had different iterations of political machinations and changes in other parts of the world. And I think that last crisis domino still is in front of us, the geopolitical. But, you know, the probabilities of a market dislocation here in 2019 are pretty high. And that's only one of the issues, though. The difference between democracies and autocracies in the way that they solve most of their problems. Again, this is very different. You were talking about letting off steam earlier, the steam train and whatnot.
Mm.
In worst case scenarios, you end up with very different behavior within a democracy versus autocracy. In a democracy, you push for changes at the grassroots level. You seek to have representation. You've got change which is driven by a particular constituency, by a particular agenda, and there's the competition for the control of that agenda. right? That defines the political fracas in the DC Beltway every day. That defines the political, you know, whatever we have, whether it's healthier, it's certainly healthier than what we have in an autocracy, but this is acute in election years. The press talks about it, right? And that's a privilege too. Press isn't always talking about things from an objective point of view, but at least they're not being censored. So we have that freedom in the West, a free press. That's not so. That's not so in China.
No.
You've got opposing views to the Politburo, which are not tolerated. You've got, as we mentioned last week, you know, this professor in China who's being censored for talking about GDP growth being more like 1.67% instead of the 6+% that's the official number from the people. So the established party line, that defines reality. That defines reality. And the established party line reflects not only the social engineering ideals, but it reflects the expected code to which everyone is supposed to comply.
Well, you know, it reminds me of a conversation I had last night with one of the gentlemen in the restaurant, and he was just wishing that there was less fake news. And I was thinking, no, we can deal with some of the fake news. We can deal with some of the noise if we have a free press. And friction, we talked in the beginning of the program about how friction can be good for us. It's good in a democratic society or a republic to have that kind of friction where maybe you can't trust all the news. Maybe there's an agenda, but you have the ability to filter that out yourself. Now, I look back at Pravda, especially when Russia was the Soviet Union. Okay. You had three Pravdas. You had the white Pravda, you had the green Pravda, and then you had the red Pravda. And different layers of that society got different levels of clarity in, maybe it was manipulated news, but they got better and better news as you moved up your way through the party.
There's a debatable issue here with fake news. I understand bad information and false information.
Right.
But I think more oftentimes what we have with journalism in the West is biased news, which is not necessarily fake. It's just information with a particular slant.
But you can filter that yourself if you know the bias.
Well, and that's where, again, you if you have a process of interpretation, back to that word hermeneutics from earlier,
right.
If you have a process of interpretation, a way of figuring out what is fact and what is an interpretation of that fact, which is perhaps, you know, above and beyond what was necessary. Again, I wonder if there's not really an exaggeration with that idea of fake news. Maybe we go back to the idea that the New York Times is going to be biased in a particular way. Mm-hmm. CNBC and MSNBC are going to be biased in a particular way. Fox News is going to be biased in a particular way.
Well, so you're making me think
objective.
You're making me think that I've actually been trained to use a word that I would have never used before. And we have to watch that, because just listening to you right now, I'm thinking I never used the word fake news until I was taught the word fake news since Trump's gotten in.
Right. It's more important that you think critically about all news than that you just excuse it outright as fake.
Right.
News is news, and it's either true or false.
And it's biased. I mean, all stories are biased.
They always will be. I read a fascinating expose from the former editor of the New York Times. And it was interesting because she said very candidly, we knew that it made sense in the first year to run as many stories anti-Trump as possible. And it would improve our readership because we knew exactly what our readership wanted. So we printed everything that we could.
Sell them what they want.
And we saw our subscriptions go through the roof. If I can find the link, I'll include it. But it was a fascinating quote from her. She spent 4 years as the head of the New York Times.
But at least it allows us in the West to let off steam.
And I guess that's the point, is that we get to let off steam in our political process. Maybe it's rancorous. Maybe that's how it seems. But guess what it is? It is relatively peaceful, and there's not a lot of blood that flows. In a command and control environment, dissent is not an option.
Right.
And so when steam builds up under the surface, it tends to end up being, or the potential is there for it to be, far more explosive. We haven't seen any explosions in Hong Kong, but certainly bringing in the new year, we had loud protests there in Hong Kong with tens of thousands of people. And you have, on average, 70,000 protests held across the country in China each year. My point is this, not only does the press not cover that, but there is more pressure on the people, more control elements within China. And yeah, again, it takes a measure of social and political pressure in China. But the environment in China is one of suppression. You don't get to express your opinions. And so when you have social and political pressure building, if you can't control it, If you can't eliminate it, okay, all this is going back to the geopolitical domino, right? Because if you can't control and eliminate social and political pressure, then there's an increased probability of geopolitical conflict.
Well, and sometimes that can be planned. I mean, the communists, no one's better at planning a demonstration or a nationalist movement than a communist party. We've even seen that in this country.
And war is a distraction. I mean, you don't have to read Orwell to know that. But because there's nothing like a nationalist conflict to rally the people, to create a crisis environment, it allows you to distract an otherwise unhappy group of people. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be an autocracy. You can be a democracy to do that. But the crackdown on dissent, that, you know, what happened 30 years ago in Tiananmen, you can refocus the negative social energy towards some positive external goal. And I think that's really what we're talking about. You've got trade wars, you've got the potential for a financial crisis because of the amount of debt and unsustainable levels of debt and bad loans within the system. And, you know, here you may be looking at kind of a scapegoat. 1919 rallied together the people who would forge the Communist Party. 2019 is a year of unease for the Chinese leadership, whether it's superstition or suspicion of a potential repeat of the 89 protests. You've got technology aiding them, and that may, with enough surveillance and control mechanisms in place, sort of maintain order. But here's my point. When you mix domestic frailties with an international trade war, the complexity of those things creates not only financial market problems, but geopolitical problems as well. And I would hate to be Taiwan right now.
Right.
Because again, it's an easy, let's do something nationalist. Let's do something that all the people who are about to protest can
rally
behind.
They could be the mouse amongst two elephants that are fighting.
And they could be the inspiration for re-expanding the Chinese army from 2 million back to 6 or even 10 million.
But you know, none of these crises really come to the surface if people are prosperous, if their wallets are thick, okay? But when the wallets start to thin down, and right now, I mean, the economic transition in China doesn't seem to be going well.
No, and I think Z can read the tea leaves. The credit expansion has happened on an unprecedented scale. And that's created the perception that not only within China was the global financial crisis skillfully handled, but that any crisis can similarly be taken in stride. And I think that's a misperception. That issue you raised, the economic transition, no, it's not gone well. You still have too high a dependence on exports, not enough internal consumption to create some independence from the old model and the vulnerabilities that come with that. But it raises the question of the implications of infinite credit creation, ultimately destabilizing, we would hold. We think that that's the case. How does that express itself? The official numbers are always going to tell the story that needs to be told.
That's the Pravda of economics.
So the expression of the reality, it won't show up in the official economic numbers. It might be an expression on the streets. It might be expressed in the negotiating rooms, perhaps even on a battlefield.
And so for the generation that grew up where Russia was the danger, and even recently Russia has captured a lot of the attention, actually we should be focusing on the greater economic giant.
Yeah, relatively speaking, Russia's the toothless tiger compared to China. Chinese financial excess, the economic instability built on an unsustainable mercantilist model, yeah, that may lead to destabilizing political and geopolitical relationships in the months and years ahead. Do we have an established red line with the Chinese on Taiwan? Of course not. I mean, we took the position back in 1979 that Beijing is the sole center of power for the Chinese, and officially we have not supported the independence of the Taiwanese. So there'd be little threat of an expanded global conflict. But again, going back to sort of this nationalist layup, if they need to score some points with their population, Taiwan's an easy layup, right? Because it's not going to implicate us. We've told them solidly since 1979 that we won't be involved. So there's the domestic political gains for the Chinese if a distraction were in order.
Well, and we're talking about China, but, you know, Trump rode in on the wave of populism based on dissatisfaction. The wallets were already getting thinner for Main Street, even though Wall Street was doing quite well.
And again, King's comments, this is, you see the increase in socialism, you see the increase in populism post-2008. So translate the same dynamics to the U.S. with economic prosperity comes greater probability of peace. With economic crisis or stagnation comes an increased probability of a very muscular foreign policy.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.